The following program is underwritten by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. Welcome to Humanities Connection, a production of WFDU-FM and the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. I'm Bob Mann. In just a few minutes, you'll hear my conversation with Verissa McMickens-Blair. She's executive director of the Roebling Museum. But first, a segment about an upcoming documentary film about a unique story. It was a sign of hope, like Noah's Ark. That's how one person in Newark described something called Kia's Ark. An artist in the 1980s actually took it upon herself to build an ark in Newark's Central Ward. Years ago, we talked about this on the air in another context. It's called Kia's Ark. It's also the name of a documentary now in production about this unique story. And on the program to talk about it is Susan Waldner. She's producer-director for PCK Media, also co-series producer for State of the Arts, which is seen here in the New York market on WNET Channel 13, in the Philadelphia market on WHYY, and also on NJTV. Susan, thank you for taking the time to be on Humanities Connection.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about Kia to begin with. An ark, I mean, the show that we did was back around 2011, 2012, so I think this is totally fresh to our audience. An ark in the middle of Newark, what was this all about?
It was something that no one had ever seen before or since, I think. She chose the highest spot of Newark, which happened to be right smack in the middle of the Central Ward, which, if you know anything about Newark, you'll know was the heart of where the late 1960s riots had really, really devastated the city. So buildings had come down, there were empty lots everywhere, and in the middle of all this sort of ruin she builds a three-story high, 86-foot-long boat.
Why? Why did
That's
she do this?
That's the question, right? I think that I never saw it, but I've seen, I've seen footage of it, photographs, talked to people who saw it. She was a person who had a strong desire to create and to build and to make use of. She was working as a demolition. She would tear down buildings. She was tearing down buildings that were built in the 19th century. They were gorgeous. They were full of beautiful wood and materials that she wanted to build something out of. So she began to teach herself how to build an ark, a boat. And she started building it and built it for years before the city took notice and said, "What is this? We don't want this here."
And there are people who you've interviewed who are in this documentary and in a piece that was done for State of the Arts who said at first they thought it was crazy. And they used the word crazy. I know that's a pejorative, but they said they admitted they thought it was crazy. And then it became a sign of the neighborhood, a sign of a rebirth.
It was, I think there was something about her that even though she was definitely eccentric, she could be gruff, she could be intimidating to people, but there was something about her single-minded focus and her drive that people really ended up responding to, I think.
Let's talk about the evolution of this documentary, because Kia's arc as a story is probably much better told in your documentary than it would be in this interview. So let's switch gears to talk about the film itself. I introduced you as co-series producer of State of the Arts. You told me before we went on the air that the State of the Arts actually was a catalyst, either a story that was done there or some research done there that led to this documentary now in production. Tell the audience about that.
Yes, that's right. And I think, if you don't mind, I'll just start at the beginning, because State of the Arts is a program that has been funded by the New Jersey State Council of the Arts since the mid-'80s, actually, and has been going on as a covering the arts in New Jersey for over 30 years. And in this time, stories that are done, and usually the stories are, you know, between 3 and 10 minutes. They're short stories. But over the years, different producers who have worked on the show have come across topics that are New Jersey topics, but that deserve to be told in a longer way, perhaps a more long-form way, getting more into the research and the original research and documentation. And so we've had documentaries that have come out of State of the Arts, and I think this is an example of that. I did a story about an exhibit that was at Gallery of Pharaoh, which is a gallery in Newark, New Jersey. It was a project that was a collaboration between Gallery of Pharaoh and the Clement Price Institute for Ethnicity, Culture, and the Modern Experience at Rutgers University, Newark, which is a handful. But they put on an exhibit with images and some of the existing, you know, still existing artwork of Kia Tawana, and it so intrigued me, and it was obvious that there was so much that was still unknown or untold about the story that I decided to not only do the short story, which is on our website and you can see it, but to go further, to do more exploring, and that's what we've done.
As a broadcaster, as a media professor, I sometimes do a short-form interview like this and say, wow, there was so much more that could be said. So I really can relate to that concept. But if you can share with the audience a little bit of what you felt was the storyline that needed to be told that couldn't be in a 5-minute piece, that just wasn't contained in what we call ENG packages but had to be a documentary film.
Well, I think that there was something about the story. It was almost that people were bringing to one of the things that Gallery of Pharaoh did, which I thought was wonderful, was they invited people from the community to share their memories of the Ark. And a lot came out from that. And it there was obvious that there was more story to be told. And so we started going down some of those sort of paths. And also there was Kia's work that had never been shown to the public before as well. Photographs that she took, drawings that she made, even things that she had created. So I think that it was still an unknown story, and the research was just beginning in this particular case.
And there's so much more to Kia Tawana than just the Ark, even though that is such an interesting and unique story. Unique is a word that is abused, but this is unique as far as anything I've been exposed to.
Absolutely.
But you, Susan, wrote these words: Kia Tawana responded creatively to her circumstances. I think she was a truly brilliant person, caught in a life without many opportunities. What do you mean that she had a life without opportunities but yet responded creatively?
Well, I think that like many other artists who are called self-taught or possibly outsider, I mean, there are different words for this, but people who sort of teach themselves how to create or to make things. And I think that there's a wonderful Bill Traylor show right now at the Smithsonian, you know, the first slave person who was born a slave who now has an exhibit in our national galleries. She was somebody who had a very hard life. There's very little known about her background. She was on her own from the age of 13, apparently. She worked her way across the country building. She was also a trans woman. She chose to be a woman during a time when people weren't familiar with that concept. She chose to live as a woman, although she had been born a man. So this was something that she had a life that was full of. She had to be brave. She had to be strong. She had to fend for herself. And nobody's 100% sure of even where she came from.
Although
so
the Brooklyn is part
create,
of
she had to create her past, but then she found herself in situations where if she wasn't going to be beaten down or just live completely on the margins, she wanted to make something of meaning in the world.
You were saying, Susan, people aren't even sure where she came from, but I understand that there were packs, little things that she put together of places other than Newark where she'd been. Brooklyn was one of them. Port Jervis was another. She had been around and had some means of documenting that.
Yes. Port Jervis is a wonderful part of the story that I think was less known before we started this documentary. She lived the last, I think about 10 years, in Port Jervis, New York, which is a small town on the river, sort of near the Delaware Water Gap. And it was a time in a life that was full of trouble and sort of hard work. It was sort of her retirement in a funny way. It was like she was part of a community that accepted her. She was friends with a gallery owner who gave her some exhibits. She had made stained glass windows, for instance, out of material she had found, stained glass windows that had been, you know, part of her demo jobs, or that she had found pieces of glass elsewhere, and she created her own original stained glass windows. They gave her an exhibit of these. She made furniture from cast-off, wood, and she was part of sort of the local community in a very friendly and accepting way that maybe she wasn't able to find in a big city like Newark or even Brooklyn.
One of the things that producers and directors can't stand is when they're in post-production and an interviewer says, "When are we going to see this?" But I have to ask you. I have to ask you because there are so many headaches in post-production. But when are we going to see this?
All right. So right now, there is a website. Well, it's a page on our website that you can get to at kias-arc.com, and that will be the place where all the news of when it's going to be online and on air will be. There will be a 5-minute short produced in probably mid-December, and then a longer piece which will come out sometime in probably the first half of 2019, which will be, I'm hoping, half an hour. Definitely longer, and the exact length is yet to be determined.
When you work in television and you have to take all this information and tighten it up into, as I say, they're referred to as packages for TV, do you feel a freedom as a documentary producer, director, or just a greater burden? How do you feel about the difference between the two different media, the two different genres?
I like both, but I think that I love the long form because I like being able to really delve into and immerse myself in material and not have to condense it. I mean, condensing it serves a beautiful function because you can't spend your life watching half-hour, hour, 90-minute documentaries all the time. It's wonderful to sort of get a sense of a project from a short piece. But sure, I like the long documentaries a lot.
I thank you very much for taking the time. Kia's Arc, you know where you're going to be able to find it, and I thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. And I also wanted to say that the New Jersey Council for the Humanities has been an incredible supporter of this project, and they've been a great supporter of State of the Arts, too, over the years.
Thank you so much for saying that. Susan Wallner from PCK Media. You're listening to Humanities Connection, a production of WFDU-FM and the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. I'm Bob Mann. This program is broadcast on 89.1 FM, and then it's archived at www.njhumanities.org. And you can go to that website to find out about all of the interesting things which are done by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities, as well as hearing archives of Humanities Connection. Some of our WFDU listeners can literally look out the window right now and see the Brooklyn Bridge. You start to take these things for granted, but really it is an engineering marvel. Not only is it a spectacular and, of course, functional suspension bridge, it was built in 1883. And the person who was the driving force was John A. Roebling. But the Roebling family goes well beyond John A. And as a matter of fact, the Roebling family is not based in Brooklyn, but in New Jersey. And their footprint really goes across the state. And right now there is a Roebling Museum in a place called Roebling, New Jersey. I've never heard about it, but it's what we're talking about on this segment of Humanities Connection. And my guest on the phone right now, speaking from the museum, is Varissa McMickens-Blair. She's executive director. Varissa, thank you for taking the time to be here on the program.
Oh, you're welcome, Bob. It's my pleasure. I'm excited to be here.
So tell us a little bit about the Roebling family. Being a Brooklynite myself, I always knew about the stories of Roebling getting the Benz and other members of his family continuing
right.
as he looked out the window at the Brooklyn Bridge being constructed. But give us a picture of this New Jersey-based family.
Right. So it's really appropriate that we're talking on a humanities show this morning, because there's a lot of folklore and story that follow the Roeblings and their families. And so people know of John A. Roebling and some of the journey that he made here from Prussia to the United States, planted himself near Pittsburgh in a place called Saxonburg, which is still there today and really still continues to celebrate the legacy of what the Roeblings planted there. That's where the beginnings of the world's use of wire rope technology began, because it was there on this little farmland that he had purchased along with his brother. That they decided that he would use those engineering skills he had come to America with to help solve some problems after seeing the Allegheny Porter's railroad system taking ship parts over the mountains in Pennsylvania and having such difficulty using hemp ropes. Roebling, John A., was already an engineer, and he saw a problem he could solve using his engineering prowess and knowledge, and he did. And he did that on his own. He gathered some other farmers. He was not a successful farmer, by the way, but was an amazing engineer, had an amazing mind. And this wire rope technology that he came up with literally has transformed the world since. From that transition to Trenton, New Jersey, where the business really took off, is because he really wanted to be someplace where the technology could build, where he could get quick and easier access to the wire to make rope, and ultimately where he began to plant a family business that lasted for so many years and impacted so many lives, not only here in New Jersey, right, from Trenton, and ultimately here in this little tiny town, this little village of Roebling, New Jersey, right in the sort of smack dab in the middle of Burlington County, New Jersey, but he really, through his company and through his innovations in engineering and that engineering prowess that he began to pass forward to his sons and his family members, many descendants beyond that, into the 1970s.
And that factory in mm-hmm. Roebling, New Jersey, and mm-hmm. you just explained to the audience, it's in Burlington County, which is
yes.
very, very central to New Jersey. You're in the Pine Barrens, right, the Pine Lands?
So we are actually near that. We're right in the middle. We're sort of tucked between Bordentown and Willingboro inside the township of Florence. And this interesting little spot is right on the Delaware. So it's one of those other river towns that sprung up during the Industrial Age. People really needed the river, and it's one of the reasons the Delaware River's existence here is one of the reasons the Roeblings have ultimately decided to plant themselves here.
Now, this is no longer any kind of plant. It is your museum. Explain what your museum has and does down there in Roebling, New Jersey.
Sure. So it's an interesting thing that about 20 minutes from Trenton, Charles Roebling, the youngest son of John A. Roebling, who was also an engineer and became ultimately a metallurgist, convinced his brothers over sort of a lot of to and fro and back and forth between them that it was important to make their own steel. There's a lot of sort of brouhaha about the idea of selling the company and what kind of offer they were getting back, and they felt sort of slighted by the offer they ultimately received from what was then U.S. Steel. And so Charles really was told by his brothers, okay, forge ahead. Create this space so you'll have a steel mill and make it, build it, do it. And Charles loved to build anything and everything. And so he didn't just build a steel mill here in this little tiny town, which was really at that time just three farms that he purchased. But he built a village, a place for his workers to live because there was no other place for them to live. And so that space, which has been closed down since 1974, has a lot of worker history, not just Roebling family history, but the workers, the descendants of the people who came to live and work here. Many of them at that point, in, as early as 1905, were first-generation Americans. And so that history is so strong here, and there's so many descendants who have stayed here that they had a real desire to turn this place, this site, into a national historic site. And they did that starting in the 70s. And ultimately, over many years, by 2009, this place, this museum, had sprung up out of many years of work, working with the EPA, working with the Army Corps of Engineers and many, many others, because this is a U.S. Superfund site.
It's great. It's a Superfund site. Well, I was going to get to the humanities aspect of it, but once you mentioned a Superfund site, that piqued my curiosity. So finish up on that, please.
Sure. So, you know, the interesting thing about being a U.S. Superfund site is that I don't think people realize that when you have industrial sort of remnant behind in a community, sometimes those sort of what ultimately become brownfields, right, those sort of reclaimed spaces, sometimes simply lay waste. People know maybe what was there. There was an old company there. There was a business there. They made this here. In Roebling, there was such an attachment to the history, such a desire to maintain and share the history of what came from here, literally the steel that rises up from the ground at the Golden Gate Bridge, right, that carries so many people back and forth, those cables and ropes, the George Washington Bridge, the Manhattan Bridge, and so many others, Bear Mountain. People know these great structures, the cables that rise up and have taken people up to the tops of the Eiffel Tower and the Sears Tower and so many other tall buildings of the world. That steel came from here. And so they wanted to tell that story. But, of course, you have the remnants of, you know, industry, which means there has to be a cleanup in order to return that space to workability and usability. And that's what happened here over many years. The cleaning of the land, the monitoring of what was in the ground and whether it was impacting the environment around it and how that, all that's been taking place since the 1980s, in fact, in 1983.
So you have a museum now that is on that site, basically. Mm-hmm. You've taken that land and that infrastructure, and you've really turned this into a museum, which is about technology, but also about history and the humanities.
Yeah, there's an interesting sort of connection between the history, the industry, the social aspects of building a planned community, and the humanities. All of the stories that rise up literally from the ground here, where we're planted inside what was the main gate building for the Roebling Company here at the steel mill.
Now, the main gate is more than just a gate. That gate was, you made reference to before, Varissa, about the fact that Roebling gave his workers a place to live. That gate really had a lot going on for it, more than just an entrance into the facility, right? There was a more significance to it.
Absolutely. So, you know, what began as literally a small gate, I mean, we have original photos and archival photos here, as well as drawings and renderings that show it just as that, this small little tiny gate so that simply provided a way to show people there was something else happening here besides, you know, just neighborhood, right? And so, you know, to tell you you were entering into a place of business. And ultimately, three or four expansions of the building over the course of its lifetime made this a central place, literally the center point between work and home for the people who lived in the village of Roebling, and they were all workers and their families. So this place is significant because, in fact, it helps to time stamp the work and the role and the importance of what happened here. It was a central place not only for the business where, you know, the old vault was, where they held the pay for the workers, or where the original time clock still is here inside this building. But it's also the place where the original ambulance house was, and the original infirmary, even the original jail, right? So the civic and civil functions of the village, of having a town owned by a company, right? All of those things lived in this building, too. And so this space becomes really important. The building itself, lovingly restored to, you know, using original blueprints and looking at all sort of the aspects of what made this an important building, we built that into the way that we display and create our exhibits here.
Sadly, the time is getting away from us, so I want to get to a couple of key points.
Sure.
First of all, your connection to our underwriter here in this program, the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. Tell the audience a bit about your connection with the Roebling Museum and the council.
Sure. So I will say, you know, we're really glad to be a part of this show because it's important for folks to know how important the New Jersey Council for the Humanities is in this state. You know, we have such a rich history here, and that history includes the stories of people, the folklore that's sort of been woven from what happened here in, you know, in terms of the industry and the history of the Roeblings and those workers. So we've been able to draw on the Humanities Council's wonderful programs around providing speakers. They have a Humanities Scholars Program where you can actually apply to bring in speakers to talk about subjects that really connect with what we're doing here in terms of that history and that culture. And that's been important to us. We've done that for 2 years in a row, and it's been incredibly important for us to be able to bring in really well-versed, knowledgeable, well-researched speakers who speak to the audience that we bring in and to our members and our visitors. And the other part of that is that, you know, we're at a place where last year, in 2017, was the 10th anniversary of this organization, the 10th anniversary of when it became an established sort of nonprofit organization. And in looking back at that, what we realized is that there's more to discover. After 10 years of operating, there's still more to do. And one of the key aspects that we really wanted to delve into was this aspect of the humanities, the stories, sort of the lives of the people impacted and how they really connect to today.
Well, let's think about what you've got here. You've got a story of immigrants. You've got a story of labor. You have a story of American ingenuity. You know, these are all things coming together in a way that really do speak to the 21st century, even though this happened so long ago. We have living monuments to Roebling, but also this is a big, big part of American history and American people. We only have a minute left, Varissa. You have so much to tell us, but let's just be really pragmatic. Our broadcast covers the tri-state area, North Jersey, New York City, the surrounding areas. Then it goes on the web at njhumanities.org so everybody can hear. So tell us exactly where you are, best ways to get there, and just really take this opportunity to promote your wonderful Roebling Museum.
Great. Thank you so much for that opportunity. And we want to encourage people to come and visit us. We are open from March through the end of December every year, Wednesdays through Sundays, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. You can reach us through our website at roeblingmuseum.org. You can also reach us by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Roebling Museum. If you look us up, you will find us on all those wonderful travel sites that talk to you about what's really interesting and good to find out, even a wonderful humanities and sort of historical site for the state of New Jersey called Journey Through Jersey. So if you're looking for those kinds of visitations, you'll find other locations nearby us that will make this a wonderful trip for any family or organization. We certainly do all kinds of things, book trips for groups and seniors and schools. So we encourage people to come and visit us. We are in Burlington County, New Jersey, in the Township of Florence, in the Village of Roebling, 100 2nd Avenue in Roebling, New Jersey.
Okay, I'm going to have to stop you there for the sake of time, Varissa, but I think people have plenty of information, and I'd love to go down there. I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for inviting us. We hope to see you and your listeners here at the museum.
Varissa McMickens-Blair, Executive Director of the Roebling Museum. That's it for this episode of Humanities Connection. I'm Bob Mann. Thank you very much for listening. This program is initially broadcast on WFDU 89.1 FM, and then it's archived at www.njhumanities.org. You can go to that website not only to hear archives of our program, but to hear about all of the fascinating programs that are being run throughout the state by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities.